Okay. Yeah, the pulses from angles. Okay. Yes, so we are the pulses from Andrew Murray's group. And so we were interested in this pulsatile invertase in expression in budding yeast, which had been kind of seen in his group beforehand, and we wanted to investigate this phenomenon a bit more closely. So just very briefly, so invertase is this enzyme which becomes expressed and is then mainly secreted. So there's a non-secreted and a secreted form, but the majority is secreted, and then this enzyme is able to hydrolyze sucrose into glucose and fructose, which then can be imported and go into the glycolysis. And so because this is secreted, so it happens outside the cell, actually the interesting question was what happens in a colony where maybe one of the cells is secreting. So here the yellow cells are the highly secreting ones. But then because they secrete the enzyme, they kind of share the enzyme and also the glucose, which comes from the hydrolytic reaction with the rest of the cells, and so maybe the other cells are not very motivated to express invertase themselves. And so one can ask whether there's actually a spatial coordination of invertase secretion in a yeast colony, which would also, well, one could make some arguments about that this is already one step further into thinking about multicellularity and so on, because there are some cells which produce it and other cells which live from the produced enzyme. And so the experimental setup which we are going to use throughout is that we have this construct which has the invertase promoter with a destabilized YFP. So that can then give you some idea about the activity of the promoter. And we also have another construct, which is a constitutive promoter with a CFP, and that just helps us to track the cells over time. Okay, so Shaul is going to tell you in length about how we try to address this question. But so what we first wanted to kind of address is, so in the literature you will find that the promoter reacts to glucose and not to sucrose, which seems already a bit funny, but that's how it is, obviously. But it was not really clear what exactly the response of the promoter to different glucose concentrations is. And so that's what I try to address by taking snapshots. So I grew my cells in actually rather low glucose concentrations, 1 millimolar. And then in the mornings, I shifted them to different glucose concentrations, so ranging from 0.1 millimolar glucose to 8 millimolar glucose, which is still low, but on the upper range of low glucose concentrations, and then grew them another 6 hours so that they reached a steady state. And then or that they adapted to the new glucose concentration, and then I imaged them and asked what is actually the intensity, so how many of these highly expressing cells do I find and how many of the others. And I hope that this would give me a general idea about how this promoter reacts, as well as maybe about how many of the cells I see in this population are actually pulsatile, because again, I don't have the time resolution, but maybe one sees that some are very high while the rest of the population is rather low. Okay, just very briefly. So I have this so that's how I set up the analysis. So I have these CFP signals. I do some Gaussian filtering, and then I do some segmentation with water shedding, and then I do some corrections like these little stuff, which is also very far on the side, so these things get thrown out, and then I get a pretty nice picture where I see my little yeast cells. And then I apply the segmentation to the YFP channel for this. So I had taken these stacks. And so I had also, before I actually started the segmentation, I actually had a little algorithm which hopefully finds my focus plane. And then I took only the focus plane plus two planes above and two planes below the focus plane. So these were like my, what I defined as my cell. And so I sum projected all this, and then I analyzed the mean signal intensity. And so that's how it looks like. So I did this actually twice to see how reproducible these results are. And so each of these curves actually reflects roughly 200 cells. It's a bit full. So what you can see is maybe, so there is 0.1 millimolar, so low glucose. And then also, at least in this experiment, there was not much happening for 0.3 and 0.6 millimolar glucose. But then at 1 millimolar glucose, I saw that actually, I mean, on average, the cells had a little bit more signal intensity, and also this tail became actually longer. So somehow the promoter seemed to react at this concentration. And then if I went further up, actually the signal dropped again and vanished completely from 4 millimolar on, which is kind of expected because we know that glucose, high glucose concentrations completely repress this promoter due to catabolite repression, because budding yeast just loves to grow on glucose. So that was very nice, I thought. So the repetition of the experiment looks sort of similar, but not quite. So again, we have 0.1 millimolar glucose here. And then I already saw that actually 0.3 and 0.6 went up a little, and then from 0.8 on, it already started to drop again, which is mainly due to the fact that it's really hard because you have the cells in these cultures which actually consume the glucose. So if you start to image a bit earlier or a bit later, you might actually already have a different glucose concentration in your tube than what you assume. And so I guess there are some experimental variability which one could, of course, try to rule out by either having some like microfluidic setup where actually you have constant exchange of the medium, or yeah, similar things. So if I wanted to do this more carefully.
But in both cases you have a non-monotonic dependence.
Yes.
I wonder if you could just say physiologically why
yeah.
it's good to have a non-monotonic.
I will come to that in a second. So at least what my hypothesis is. So just quickly, because that's actually more what we do in our later experiment, I compared 0.3 millimolar glucose with 0.3 millimolar glucose plus 8 millimolar sucrose. And if you look, this increases the expression a little bit. So obviously, if you have a little bit of glucose around and you have sucrose in addition, from which you can maybe produce more glucose by expressing inotase, that helps your own expression. And then, yeah, I also had a very high concentration of sucrose, which looked very similar to the one with sucrose and glucose. Hard to say, also because I don't have a replicator for this data. Yes?
What would you expect of glucose contamination?
In this very high sucrose? Yeah, it could be significant. So that's why I think this.
When it comes out of the water, sigma changes to less than 0.1%. But this is as soon as it comes out of the water, right? Because sucrose auto-catalyzes in water, because it's actually hydrolyzed carbonated bond. So this is why we keep it in the fridge, blah, blah, blah. But yes, it has a finite shelf life as sucrose.
Okay. And so, well, to summarize this data, well, so what I have seen is at high glucose concentration, expectedly, we repress the invertase expression, and at very low glucose concentration, it also seems like you repress the invertase expression. And I think under physiological circumstances, this makes completely sense because in both these situations, there is actually no value of expressing invertase. So the value of it is really if you express a little bit of invertase and kind of as a reward for expressing invertase, you actually have glucose import, then this is a situation where you actually want to express more invertase. And we kind of trick ourselves into this situation by just giving them a very defined concentration of glucose in the first place so that we kind of we cheat them into doing this thing. But so that's why I think this non-monotonic behavior can be explained, so that you have some feedback in the system which tunes the system to express invertase only actually in the presence of sucrose and not in the other situation, because here you want to maybe swap to a completely different carbon source and you don't want to express invertase if there's no sucrose around. Okay. So that's for my part in the moment. So, and now we are trying to implement this whole thing into what actually happens in a spatial setup, so when we look at a microcolony. Okay.
Anyone knows anything about Mac? Like how we connect this?
So go to system settings and say, is that something's happening?
Okay, so as Yulia was saying, we want to look at the spatial control gene expression of the invert. We even expect this gene to have spatial control because the cells secrete the invertase gene onto the periplasmic space, where it hydrolyzes sucrose into glucose and fructose, and then the glucose mostly diffuses away. So you expect to have a gradient of glucose concentration around an invertase producing cell. And because of the non-monotonic shape of the response of the gene to glucose concentration, you maybe will expect to have some spatial correlation in gene expression. So the first thing we did was we just took movies. So I'm going to just show you a bunch of movies. So first, I want to convince you that the cells really pulsate. So we did this in two conditions. One is glucose, and the other one is lower concentration of glucose and somewhat higher concentration of sucrose. Can't you see?
So it might be, you might have to drag it into the imaginary side screen of yours, right?
Okay, so this is cells in glucose, and there are what you're seeing is their YFP expression, and this is a destabilized YFP. Seems like they're pulsing, right? So now we have the same thing in sucrose, and they also seem to be pulsating. This is a much shorter video.
So they're
actually pulsating at about the same time. You can see them. Okay, so now I convince you that they really pulsate and I have points where you can say. I want to show you how I did the segmentation. So this is just the prediction map from Elastic for one movie, and this is for the other movie. And we performed the segmentation of that, and then Sebastian wrote a software that tracks these cells over time, and this is how it looks. So each little circle is a lineage, and it
does a pretty good job in following the lineages of the tumor. Well, yeah, in the glucose group, you see that you have these cells coming from over here, so obviously not many of you. And the same for the cells. And this is the end of the coolest and interesting part. Okay, so these are individual tracks, and you can recapitulate the forcing after computational analysis. So the left panel is the low glucose, and this panel is the glucose and sucrose. And you see these are just some examples of cells. But the y-axis is just YFP intensity, so they are obviously closer.
You can move on the right, it's much shorter.
Right, this is 35 and this is 100. You typically get only one pulse here in several places.
And are the temporal variations the same?
Yeah, so every image is 10 minutes in both movies. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the time here is in frames. Okay, great. And what can we now maybe try and do? We can try and characterize these things, but I didn't have time or knowledge on how to do these things, so I didn't do that. What I did do is, well, actually Sebastian did that, is to look at each cell and look at all its neighbors and see if plot the YFP intensity of yourself versus the mean YFP intensity of all the cells around. And if we expect there to be any form of spatial correlation, we expect to see some correlation. And if we don't, then we won't. So what we expect is for here there to be just stochastic pulsing, so basically no correlation in space. And for here we expect correlation in space, but basically we expect negative correlation, because what you expect is that a cell that is highly expressing invertase to produce a large concentration of glucose around it, which will repress the expression of invertase in all the cells in its environment. And this is what you see here. So in the x-axis, yeah, it's not very pretty picture. In the x-axis, you have your own YFP intensity, and in the y-axis, you have the average YFP intensity of all your neighbors. So a general feature is that at the low end, you have a really broad distribution, because you're basically sampling everything. You're sampling the entire distribution of YFP intensities, because you could either be next to a cell that inhibited you and you would be low, or you could just be next to cells that didn't initiate a pulse yet and you also didn't initiate a pulse.
So you can gate on the cell in question being on.
Right, you could.
I see.
But how would you get? Would you get from here, and then you would get a nice, or a kind of nice correlation? Like it's you need some more smart way of doing it.
Sorry, what did you see? The left plot, the right plot?
Right, I forgot to. So this is glucose only.
That's
sucrose. So you see here that basically you have no correlation, only a positive correlation, kind of, maybe because of linear effects. And here, you see that very highly producing cells are basically inhibiting all the cells around. Okay?
I mean, there's a kind of anti-correlation.
It's not the previous data, but you can kind of maybe imagine. So, of course, a really important control experiment would be to do exactly this experiment with each other, like maybe a mutated invertase gene. So it's not the effect of sucrose.
Now, the other thing that we have in JDO's work now, this is so these guys can't import sucrose, so that's why they have to rely on this external oscillating thing. There's one strain that imports sucrose and can die and kill it inside the cytoplasm. Then you'd expect again the spatial correlation to die, because essentially they're now relying on import and removal rather than this external.
Yes. I think you would get better correlation if you sort of plot the mean, you plot the maximum YFP intensity of the neighbor, the neighbor with the maximum YFP.
Right, of course, yeah. You see that very well.
Yeah.
But I mean, yeah.
This was my rotation project when I learned algebra. I was really capable of learning biology. But this is great. I'm sure I'm going to be really happy.
Why is he in
squat? Why is he in squat? Well,
I'm sorry.
But that's why we're recording.
Yeah, he watches
him.
Okay, so I think now, because Jazar cannot be right now here, but should be here. Oh, never mind. You want to speak now? So we'll switch here a second and then we'll go back to interface. So what Paddy, Matthias, and I did was not working actually on the interface problem, but more looking at these clumps formed by yeast and trying to understand how they break. And I explain quickly why. So Andrew's lab was able to develop this strains of SAVZ that was able to form these different clumps. Like here, I just show some of them. You can see some of them are really tiny, some of them form really big things. These are all the same scale. There are two different ways in which they form these clumps. One is by lineage, so the idea is that the mother divides the mother and the daughter, and the cell wall between the mother and the daughter doesn't divide completely, so they stay attached over time. The second way was by expressing this gene that produces gluten, the sticky gluten on the surface of the yeast that makes the cell sticky, and then if two cells are really close to each other, they tend to stick. So there are two different mechanisms. This one's reported here as the lineage kind, which is the one we focused on at the beginning. So it's relatively clear how these clumps form, but it was less clear how these clumps actually break. And that was what we were interested in looking at, in particular if different morphologies had different weak points, if you want, that are more subject to breaking rather than others. So what we did was taking the strains of these clumps, trying to separate the big ones from the others and break them, and take the size distribution over time to see what we could do. So initially we just, we had to develop some kind of protocol to separate the big ones from the small ones and then breaking them. So the separation was done in a very low-tech way using a sucrose gradient where you create like a mixture of sucrose at different concentrations, and then you spin, you put the cells in, the clumps in, and you spin it, and then the heavy cells, the heavy clumps, so the bigger clumps will drop to the bottom, and instead the smallest clump will stay on top. And so depending on the level in which you like sample this sucrose column, you can get different size of clumps. Then the second way was using the FACS, we tried twice. The first time we went in the morning and we found that all our cultures were badly contaminated, so we couldn't use it. The second time, it almost worked, but I think Matthias is going to talk more about that second trial. Anyway, so in the end, the data that I'm going to show you
uptick in doing this superless gradients with this loop type technique. Then we wanted to break this class. So initially, actually, we just took a movie, hoping that they would break over time, and nothing happened. They kept going, filling the whole screen, the whole frame, and nothing happened. So we said, okay, maybe we have to help them breaking a bit. So we tried different things. Other sonication, thanks to Boris, who gave us his sonicator, but sonication apparently was not strong enough to break these clamps. So we tried pipetting them up and down really hard, and that worked a bit better, but there were still like big clamps remaining.
How were you growing them in the first place? These were in static.
No, it's in a shaker.
Which is a shaker. Mm-hmm. Even then, they keep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they get like some of them.
They don't break. Wow.
Like the big ones, like this. Mm. Like you can see it with your bare eye. It's impressive. Yeah. So yeah, the most fruitful method was using this really thin needle and a syringe and really push them really hard up and down and. Using audio and visual signals to understand if the protocol worked. Anyway, this was actually the most successful method. And we do see breakage in this case. It's many single cells breaking off. And then we take pictures over time, and we segment them. And this is familiar, this is the typical sample. So all this yeast expresses and cherries, so we can look at them in the under the fluorescence and be able to count the clumps and then get an idea of the size from the area occupied by each clump. Okay, then let's see first of all if the protocol works. So these are distributions of like two different strains. I start with the good ones, which is this one. So here it's a cumulative distribution. This is the fraction of clumps with an area bigger than X, and this is the area. Yes. So you expect to start from something that goes around 1, go all the way down to something that goes to 0. So the blue line here is the initial. So before we do anything, and we just put them under the microscope and look at them, this is the distribution we have. So yeah, in this case, with this 531, we have a peak around this, 8,000 or something. Pixel scales. Then we do the superless gradient and we select the big ones, and indeed we see that this curve shifts to the right, so we tend to get bigger cells. Then we break them with a syringe, and they shift back to the left, so in the end we are breaking the big clumps and small clumps. So this was a good case. Most actually of the cases may look more like this one, which, although the difference maybe is not very significant, they actually go in the opposite direction. Like you start from the blue one here, after the superless gradient, which looks like I should select the big ones, they actually move to the left. So they become smaller. And then after you break them, it actually moves back to the right, so they become bigger. And I mean, beyond going too much into the details and what we were starting conjecturing, in the end, I think the take-home message is that small clumps like these ones, that look like these ones, are really hard to break. Instead, the big clumps, like the other one, the 531, which is this one, the protocol seems to work a bit better. So, yeah, so the idea is that like, maybe it's not so efficient as the protocol in the small clumps, but for the big clumps, it seems to work. Okay. Another thing we were interested in, particularly because we did a journal trial working through another group and another strain of this that also was for clamping, was what's the expected distribution of breaking in this? So if we think about it in a very naive way, is if you have these clamps that are formed by division, they expand like a tree because it's a linear clamping. And you just assume that each physical link may break uniformly. What you get as a distribution of size of the smaller clump is something that looks like this. And again, actually, so the actual distribution is 1 over the size of the clump. It just like happens to be that. So what you see, if you compare like the red line here, the model with this one, like, you would expect many, many more single cells if they all the physical links would break in poly. And instead, we get many more big clumps instead. So we think that this happens because cells that are older, or physical links that were formed initially in the growth of the clump, are more likely to break. And this may be, I mean, this is actually a surprising considering that cells that are, the older cells that are in the middle of the clump are deprived of food, so they may be sicker, and you know, it's more likely maybe they're bigger. So this is what we found. But anyway, because we were having a bit of hard time with this,
it's a hard time you've been having with it, but there is a much more positive interpretation of this, which you sort of mentioned, but you keep talking about hard times. You basically find that the big clumps break and the little clumps are stable. So somehow looking more carefully at the horizontal axis, the finding is that the stuff on the 10 to the 4th doesn't break very much.
Yeah, that's
so, and that seems like an interesting and strong conclusion.
Just doing
a sales job for you.
I was trying to sell the product.
As a reference, one is selling this thing is approximately 1,000 pixels with this microscope.
How do you account for the fact that when you grow these different strains, they grow fine, so they obviously divide, and some they break up when they are growing?
Yeah, so that actually we were really, so when we did the first time, we were really expecting that.
Yeah, they must
be. But I mean, it's unclear, I mean, because after a bit, everything gets very, very crowded, so it's hard to say without shaping them. It's hard to say if they were really breaking or if they were just, like, they were breaking, but they were just, like, next to each other because of the confined space. Mm-hmm. Or if, I mean, I expect at some point they will have to break naturally.
Very much, yeah.
I think it's possible.
Just a question. So, how do you get the area of the clump? So, you choose the plane?
Yeah, you choose the plane of maximum focus on that. So, the idea is that. I assume that the clump is more or less spherical, which you know it is. But like if this is the whole clump with all the single cells in it, like you get like the section more or less in the middle, and that's the area. And then you count the size, assuming that you have a sphere, and you know how much one cell is. And So anyway, we move to then another strain. And I think
that this is going to talk about that. Yes, so as Diana told you, we changed the system a little bit because that's something where Sri was telling us we know that this works. When people live in the lab, they evolved this strain. So they had a non-clumping strain. They had a wire feed under the control of a certain promoter, and they did a selection where they selected for low YFP expression in the morning and for high YFP expression in the evening. And what they saw at the end of the experiment is that they didn't evolve something that changes the transcription from this promoter, but they just have clockwise clumping. So their signal cells in the morning and their clumps in the evening. And the moral behind this is that when there are signal cells in the morning, they are sticky. So while they're growing, they stick together, and somehow the stickiness seems to be controlled in a clockwise manner. So in the evening, they're less sticky, or they become less sticky overnight, and they disperse into single cells, and the cycle goes on again. And that's why we hoped it would be easier to detect breakages in this strain. So we started with a time-lapse experiment, and we looked at big cells, or big clumps, to see whether they break. And what we saw is that they break, so they shed off like smaller clumps, but in the movie we did, we could never see that they then go to single cells and produce single cells offsprings, but they just grew up clumps again. And so that's basically the day when Fabio made Andrew nervous, because he proposed this Fabio model, which is strains are always clumpy and always sticky. They grow to critical size, and once they reach this, they clump and grow up again. And Andrew did a very like quick and dirty model of that, and he realized that if he chooses the right parameters, this reruns almost the same time, for the same time as the other model does. And our goal was then to help Andrew to figure out which model is true. So we again did the same protocol with the sucrose gradients. We selected for small cells, for big clumps, and we broke up the clumps to see, to test these hypotheses. What we see for the small ones is they start small and they grow up, and at some point they get smaller again. So for this is more or less in series with the clock model, because we expect them to grow higher for up to 6 to 9 hours, that's what we see. And then after 10 hours, the clock model says that they will break in single cells again. Also, this fits pretty well with the clock model. So if we look at the big strains, they start big, and then they get smaller over time. And
they don't get big again in that time.
No, because the experiment was done that the day cycle was 10 hours, uh-huh. and the night cycle was 14 hours, so we wouldn't expect them to go gathering.
And so how does that play out with the small cells? Because you do get them going back down.
Yes, because their cycle is only 10 hours, okay. So we expect them to go back between 9 and 12 hours. Yes? Dina says
it. I'm just, so I had a weird idea before when I was very sleepy, and the idea is like maybe the growth rates of different size of the clumps, they're different, mm-hmm. so that when they're very small, the growth rate is slow, so they prefer to stay together to increase into a certain size of the clumps, then the growth rate is slow down because the cells inside of the clumps, they don't have enough nutrients, mm-hmm. so then they break off to increase the growth rates. So it's kind of, they are optimizing their population growth. Mm-hmm. It's just an idea.
So
I don't know whether it's true.
This is the same model that I think Diana proposed at some point, and mm-hmm. it's quite possible, but it's still a clock if you think about it, right? You're saying that when they are in a clump, they are different in some sense from when they are free. Mm-hmm. So maybe that's how it works. Nobody quite knows how this works mechanically.
But they still know about what they are.
But the cells are still aware in some sense of whether they are in a night, in an evening stage, so in the clump, or whether they are free.
Could it be just something about adaptation to the transfer regime, or that the environment is changed by the growth of the organism?
Right.
So they evolve to.
So this clock strain. So they
depending on the environment.
Right. So the paper kind of argues that by doing this selection, the cells become aware in some sense or the other of whether they are in a decline or not. In the alternative model we were trying to kind of test, and it simply is to say maybe it's just a biophysical effect. It says the same, but just by the fact that they're together, you get like compounding into the distribution.
Good. So far, we didn't have an answer for which model we should favor. So we really put our hope in this last experiment where we break the big cells up. So if Fabio's model is true, these cells should just grow back again to the bigger clumps. If the clock model is true, then these cells should stay in a small clumps or even single cells. That's where things start to get messy. So we start as small clumps, we go up, we go further up. So at least in the beginning, they start to grow. So this would favor Fabio's model. But we also see that after some time, they start to go down again, which doesn't really fit to any of the models.
Why doesn't it fit my business model? So the model basically says that once they reach supercritical size, they
or a certain critical set of conditions in the environment, because as these cells are growing, they're changing their environment, they're depleting resources, so that could be a stimulus.
I think one other part to keep in mind is that the Fabius model predicts that they will get to a critical size only at a certain time. So the problem is here that there's two variables essentially trying to keep track of. They're trying to say in a certain amount of window of time, at the end of it, they have to be here. Right? It's what the clock model is saying. Because we don't really know what's happening in the middle.
So after 6 hours, they did start to break. And if this would be true, then we wouldn't see the clock-like behavior, because the time points wouldn't break.
How would they synchronize?
This is still too frozen. That's one of the problems. Yeah. So we have a problem with synchronizing them. We couldn't use the facts, and so we could have confirmations of all different categories we have. And so we cannot really be sure that we have in the exact.
So basically, since they're not synchronized, you don't have any expectation on the basis of the plot model.
We hope that we get the synchronization good enough to have some expectations, but we clearly didn't yet.
I think also, I mean, because you only took the big ones, right?
Yes.
So you kind of had hope that by just doing the supers and taking the big ones, they would be kind of pseudo-synchronized,
yes.
Right? Because they only get big at a certain time of the day.
Mm-hmm.
It's a cycle, so by this you would just take the population. But of course it's not like running three fact cycles.
Exactly.
In 3 days,
so
right?
After seeing this, we decided that we want to do an experiment with the facts. So this involves like several fact cycles to synchronize when they're coming out of the freezer. And we managed to get down one fact cycle. For the second one, the fact was already broken, so other horses were using it during the day, so we couldn't use it in the evening anymore. And we still tried to do the same experiments, but we have a problem with the signal to noise ratios so of working. Switch to microscopes, people science in different microscopes, and basically that's what we see. So we didn't get a lot of images in this segment. So the question is still open, and
which is on the sides?
This is on the sides, yes. So we get some images in the cows that look okay, but we have, for especially this is small cells.
Oh.
So with the small cells we have lots of problems with the noise ratio.
As part of Fabio's model,
yes,
they get this crystal size and then presumably you predict they disperse all at once in the time zone.
No, they
don't. They start shedding.
Yeah,
they
should
start shedding. So the events were sub-crystal size that also encourage them to grow up again.
That's exactly
it. Well, so the idea is that if you reach a critical size, the next generation double the population, right?
Right.
But you cannot grow. So, you know, half of some, all, you know, you project out into space
much less,
as many single cells as are, you know, making up your plant at this time.
Yeah.
And they will start growing all in sync, right?
Yeah.
So you create wave, like traveling wave, just because you take all the clumps of the initial time point, and then they start shedding off waves of small cells that grow up the clump at the same time. Right?
So if you look at time, it's small, bigger.
So
then it would suddenly distribute into biggest and smallest.
Yeah. Right. So you expect to see binomials.
Smallest.
So you expect that the first, you know, you expect that in the first generation or something, you see bimodality. This is what we try to do, but you know, you have
so as the entry numbers in the clock, but there were no big ones left.
So this is the biggest essential problem. Like,
right.
You sort of see it's all facts and so you sort of see this thing where it looks like when there are big ones, there's a shoulder. When there are small ones, it looks sort of flat with more tail towards the small one. So it's kind of ambiguous and can't tell one way or the other.
That's
Yes, so what we achieved is we made Andrew think. We unfortunately couldn't get experiments done that would favor one or the other model, but I hope we started to do some of them, and maybe once you're back in the lab, we'll get the answer, hopefully,
yeah.
To get it figured out. And so I want to finish with our running gag of the Shearing protocol, and I would like to thank again Andrew and Sri and the whole group because we had really, really fun times in these 2 weeks. Do you want to switch computers?
Sure.
I
can just explore it as a PDF then. No, I can explore it as a PDF. Maybe the next group can go first. Sorry about that.
Sri, do you have PowerPoint?
Yeah. Or you can just, yeah. She has Keynote.
No, I have PDF now.
So now she has a PDF, so now we are taking the extra few minutes.
Yeah. This is a good time for someone to get up and get tea and coffee.
Well, it's going to be lunch. We won't be back for an hour.
10-minute break? Should we do a 10-minute break?
Yes.
But this is only. Oh, you're ready.
Okay. I'm ready.
Yeah.
I'm ready.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we'll have lunch?
Yeah, lunch and then come back.
No. Oh, no lunch? And we just go out and have barbecue?
Yeah, because we're going to have barbecue, okay. We can start sort of fairly early, especially if we're down here.
All right, yeah. So you said it's just similar to that number?
We have some
sure we can do it.
Right, so we can Joel's start. Kind of so, well,
he just wants a beer.
Listen, that's for your people to decide. But we can start grilling there at 4, right? And we will be ready for
And it's similar.
But now, the matter of fact, that we can also start earlier, right?
Yeah, we can also start earlier.
Yeah, we might as well start earlier, yeah. The one thing while it is getting set up is the lab. It'd be great if people could go to the lab. First of all, make sure there's nothing on the bench that you want to keep, because everything is going to be thrown away. But if you could also then take all of your plates, all of the stuff that is done with, and Aileen will provide autoclave bags to put material in. So if you could go down to the lab for, I don't know, it won't take more than 10 or 15 minutes if everyone does that, lifts a hand.
Yeah, just don't throw out any Microsoft objectives.
Oh, but then that's my mask here, I don't know.
Okay, thank you for the wait, and sorry about the slight difficulty. So I'm in Andrew's group and with the posters. So my main question when I started off in the posters group is what's the advantage of making invertase extracellularly anyways? I missed the part where my teammates were talking about the invertases, so I'm not sure how much details you've already seen. And if you haven't seen enough details about this invertase production mechanism, Sue's here, so he's the expert on that. Okay, so that's the main question I wanted to ask. And to answer that question, so it's a PDF, so there are very condensed and pretty information-loaded slides. So let me walk you through them. So these are the cells I'll be working with. And so the top two are the main competitors. I want to figure out which one is more beneficial or growthfully more advantageous. So the yellow cells are the environmentalists. They sense the environment glucose concentration, and correspondingly, they will produce invertases to digest some complex sugar sources if glucose level is low. The self-sponsors are these orange cells. and they will actually have a complex sugar importer. They will bring the complex sugar in and digest it and then be able to eat it later on. Okay? So ultimately, I want to figure out which one of these two is more fit. So I have the better plan is to let them grow competitively together with a range of nutrient concentration. In my case, in my experiments, the concentrations are all glucose, minimum glucose with various concentration of sucrose. Okay? And another thing to do this experiment, namely to see whether this competition or this result is a transformative one, is to let them compete indirectly against a common enemy, basically. So the common enemy, in my case, is this clumpy cells. They always produce invertases, okay, at all the time. And these are the pulsars that you have seen earlier. Actually, these are a little bit different from the pulsars you've seen earlier on. So the pulsars you might have seen earlier on, they clump together. They will sense the region glucose concentration together. They will sense the environment glucose concentration and then locally produce invertase and benefit those neighboring cells that are near them as the digested sucrose flow away. But these clumpers, they always produce invertase, so it's a slightly different cellular mechanism. Okay? So direct combat, indirect combat, and the judges are read the plate. These are the old-fashioned, the Andrews Poorman's experiment design. Just on the plates because they have different drugs. And also we look at the fluorescence imaging as well as FEC. There's no sorting involved in this case. Okay, so first of all, the direct competition. So I apologize for the terrible, terrible color scheme. I really didn't have time to make it any better. Before I let them do the competition in the same environment, I want to find out how do they grow on their own. So the five different nutrient concentrations throughout this whole set of experiments are 0.5 millimolar glucose versus no sucrose, 2, 4, 8, 16 sucrose concentration. Okay? So if you look at the growth curve, the environmentalists typically grow a little bit slower than the self-sufficient cells, which to me was a little bit surprising because I would think, you know, that's sort of an indication to me that making this importer could be cheaper than making a whole bunch of invertases and then kind of let them diffuse around. So that's this five panels were telling me, okay? The spikes in the growth curves are due to plates being taken out, so don't worry about that. Alright, so now I have the baseline sets. I'm gonna let them directly compete. So I mix these two populations of cells. At t equal to zero, the population is normalized to 1:1, so the ratio initially is just always 1:1. And again, horizontally are these five different set of nutrient concentration. So one would imagine after 20-hour independent growth, the ratio will be something like this. Okay, that's purely based on the individual growth curve. But then when I let them actually compete after 20 hours, what you see is instead of being a close game, the environmentalists actually really lose out as long as there are a lot more sucrose.
Just remind me what the phenotype of the environmentalist is.
The phenotype of the environmentalists are unicellular.
Yeah, I know.
They make invertases.
They're producers.
They produce.
And the other ones express the
transporter, so they can take complex sugar and digest.
No, so that's it. So one cannot take up sucrose directly, so must hydrolyze sucrose externally and share glucose that is therefore produced. The other one can actually import sucrose and digest it internally, so they don't care.
That's only produce.
No, so they can also make invertase, so they do both.
So one can scavenge, the other is
So neither of them are scavenging effectively from the other. One can take up from the pool more directly, the other one can't.
Wait, orange import sucrose
and glucose. So everyone can import glucose, yeah, right? If you see glucose, you feed.
So the only difference is between orange and yellow is that orange also can directly utilize the sucrose.
Exactly.
And both of them can utilize glucose, and both of them secrete and convert it.
Yes, that's an important point. Thank you for pointing out. Because orange ones, they will use the glucose if they exist in the environment. It's not that they exclusively.
So just be clear, so the orange should have no advantage over yellow in the absence of sucrose. Like that's just as a reality check, right?
Correct.
In fact, they even have a disadvantage.
Yeah. Exactly. Okay. So the difference is very small in between these two guys. So this is actually in the absence of sucrose. And if you start orange and yellow one-to-one, 20 hours later, you will have slightly more orange than yellow.
That's what these reference.
No, growth rate difference is very small. So if you only consider growth rate, let them grow independently of each other. That will give you the growth rate difference. But if you let them compete, so all of a sudden these guys, they have a slight advantage over the yellow ones because they can not only do their own thing. Well, in this case, they don't need to do anything. They can just use the glucose that's floating around in the environment produced by the yellow guys.
No, but the yellow guys can also use that. I'm confused. Well, they shouldn't have it. Orange should have no advantage.
But in order to use the glucose in the... Oh, I see.
When there's no sucrose. Okay, so here's where a little bit of cleaning comes in. Mm-hmm. It's not entirely clear the sucrose importer can't import glucose. So essentially, you're bumping up your import capability. Okay. It's maybe. It's not known.
Okay. But I guess the key point here is that the orange's advantage is clearly sucrose dependent.
Yes.
So I think that's the main point, right?
Yes. Yeah. Yes, absolutely. Okay. And this advantage gets amplified as you give them more and more sucrose. Yeah.
Well, so effectively they're competing for sucrose.
Yeah.
And they are sending sucrose away from the breakout.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
So
that's
the direct
thing.
Yeah.
So when you have this high concentration of sucrose, you have some level of glucose still, right?
0.5, yeah.
So presumably if you come instead of after 20 hours, after 5 hours, nothing's happening because they're just giving all glucose.
That would be my guess, but I didn't check.
This is just natural,
huh? Yeah, this is, you mix them 20 hours later, I come.
Can you just remind me, are any of the three genotypes wild type?
Or none of them. Mm-hmm.
They're all
engineers.
They're all engineers.
The environmentalist. 1 second. The environmentalist clumps and is otherwise wild type.
No, no, no. So the environmentalist is wild type. It's wild type except for the fluorescent protein.
Okay.
No.
Oh.
Good.
So the environmentalist
so blue is basically wild type.
Yeah. No, not blue.
No.
Yellow.
Blue.
No.
Oh, the environmentalist. Sorry. Yellow is basically wild.
Because that's what yeast doesn't like. They produce invertase secreted.
Okay.
Wild, they do this in the lab.
Not in the lab.
In the wild, they have the importer. So that's essentially the question.
Okay, so orange is the wild type.
So it depends on what you want to call wild type. Wild type being outside in nature, or wild type being what's in your lab?
The lab strain has a mutation relative to
the lab strain has lost the ability to import complex sugars.
I see. And so you put this gene back from an ancestral wild type strain. I see.
To make the yellow.
So the yellow is the domesticated yeast. You can think of it that way.
Orange is like
wild genotype.
Okay. Orange is wild type. Yeah, or resembles wild type. And yellow is merely lab wild type. Yeah. Let's call yellow is lab. Orange is the ancestral wild
nature.
And blue is
another version of the wild.
So there's
two. Blue is also clumping is another thing that wild yeast do.
But again, it's been added back to the wild lab strain.
Exactly. Okay. So that's
the first round of.
One question. So yeah, after 20 hours, were they very dense? So could it?
Yeah.
Maybe that was
the you can
so
look at the chicken
plates and expect that actually one of them has been called, I mean, the stationary phase was reached later.
My real goal, my aim, is to set them at the concentration so that during the 20-hour time period, they will always be exponentially growing, and I give them plenty of medium.
But you said they were very dense, so they were probably not exponentially
growing. Well, okay, but when I look at the growth curve, the doubling rate is about 2 to 3 hours for these cells, and I choose the concentration so that, I guess, yeah, that, you know, again, I think they are exponentially growing.
How much is the cell density again, approximately?
10 to 6.
They're not in stationary. You reach stationary in detail with 10,000.
Right.
10,000 is still
right. But 10 to 6 is cloudy, very cloudy.
No, that's because it's minimal detail. You can see
that
there's growth.
That's where you start.
That's when they end up on that.
At least for us, you have a lot of growth as the wine is
At the moment, yes, at the moment they are. You see, that's why they're so small. Okay, so the next round of experiment is let them compete indirectly. So, yellow, I'm just going to stick with my color scheme. So, the yellow versus blue, and the orange versus blue. And you can keep track of what the their genealogy is. So, okay, so what we're looking at here, let's take a look at the top five panels. So what we have here is five different concentrations, and then the scales on the later three ones are much bigger than the first two. So what that tells us is for the later three concentrations, the clumpers win, okay? So there are bigger, colony sizes emerging if you have a higher sucrose concentration. And something similar happened in the second round of indirect competition, namely as you increase the sucrose concentration, the clumpers win. So if I want to draw a definitive conclusion between yellow and orange, it seems like this is the only part that I can take a look and say, oh, okay, if the yellow one lost to the blue and the orange one won the blue, okay, then the orange won the yellow, which is still consistent with what we have seen.
Why did the orange one lose ever? Because the orange one can eat its own secret, and it can eat everything with the blue person, the blue guy.
Right. Then why bother making in their case anything?
Well, I mean, just why is the orange one lose?
To the blues?
Yeah.
To these guys?
So the blue has.
The blue guys club together. Oh, so here's an important thing. The blue guys constantly has this invertase on, so they don't pulse. They always, whatever environment they're
right,
in.
Right, so the orange guy can eat the blue guys, I'm making. So
probably naturally it's localized and consumed within the clump.
I mean,
so the cooperativity advantage shows up in these cases.
So you said the blue don't have this metabolite repression anymore, right? It's constantly
Yes.
So they, you know, they don't wonder about what's out there. They just take everything, hydrolyze,
and
utilize everything.
Exactly.
Properly.
Perhaps it's when you've got high sucrose concentration, the energy expended unnecessarily potentially at lower sucrose concentrations means blue is uncompetitive against orange, but that probably works out the other way.
The part that's confusing to me is the fact that the yellow won in the last one.
Yeah. This is very annoying to me too, yesterday when I saw this data. This bothers me. So then I went to another type of fluorescent machine, which is the flow cytometer, to take a look at the results of the indirect competition. So the previous ones are done from the taking microscope images, and I would love to thank Sebastian for helping me, having a crash course on image analysis yesterday afternoon, and then I was able to do these when I got home. So, okay, using the fax machine, So the fax machine, even though I used it in my first project as well, but I'm still not a fan of it. So what we have here is
actually there should be a scale.
Yes, good. So what we have here is the logarithmic forward scattering versus the fluorescent protein label. So initially, the way to tell these two strains apart is by their slightly different fluorescent labeling. And in the end, the slight difference turned out to be quite slight. So fluorescent-wise, it's not really easy to tell them apart, but from the morphology of it, namely how clumpy they are, it's a little bit easier, and that's why I chose to look at the forward scattering to figure out. So at the very least, at the very first glance of this flow cytometry data, what we can see here is a slight separation of sizes. Okay, I apologize, this panel block the other two, the rest, because it's a PDF now. But these look qualitatively similar, so there is a promising sign to say using the flow, we can separate the two types of particles based on their cluster size. But in summary, you know, through this several rounds of competition under these five concentrations, it seems like overall the orange guys, the ones that make sucrose importers, has an advantage over the yellow. But in addition to this conclusion, it's also nice for me to just go through some experimental techniques and to learn all these fun things. So I'm gonna thank the people in my group. And the first one is clearly Sui, because if I propose an idea of or ideas of doing experiments, he would just say, absolutely, do it. And then in our group meetings, one thing Andrew always says when we have heated discussions, he would just say, well, I would just want to mediate this and propose something really kind. And then also the teammates, you know who the first one is clearly, but it's really nice to have worked with all of you, and I would like to thank Boris and all the organizers and the PhD scholar program to let me be here. So.